Today, we ask why there has been a spate of homeless deaths in one of the most affluent cities in Britain. And The Observer's Nosheen Iqbal on the academic who says white people are so fragile when discussing race.
If I see a ladybird right there now, right, I'll grab the ladybird and hold it in the hand, yeah?
That's the voice of Sharon Maz. According to a letter in The Guardian from her former headmaster, she was a bright, lively and sensitive girl, a keen cyclist and an all-round athlete.
Some people are lacking that love, you know, that extra love.
On the 21st of January, Sharon died after a long period of sleeping rough in Oxford. She was just 44.
Just because you're on the streets, you're not a piece of rubbish. I mean, nobody knows the stories.
It was the fourth homeless death in the city since November. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, a spate of homeless deaths in one of the most affluent cities in Britain. Why did you decide to write about homelessness in Oxford?
We'd received a tip that there'd been a spate of deaths of homeless people and people in the homeless community in the last few weeks. And it seemed, especially given it was so cold, a good time to go and find out what was happening and to try and investigate who were the people who had passed away and why they'd passed away in a city like Oxford where you perhaps wouldn't expect it.
Rob Booth is social affairs correspondent at The Guardian.
It has a relatively high rough sleeping rate compared to other towns. It attracts lots of people from around and about, partly because of the generosity of people when people are begging on the streets, but also because, you know, there is a large homeless community there, so people support each other.
How many deaths have there been, and who were the people who died?
So since November, there were four deaths that we know about. There was Sharon Maz, who died on the 21st of January, and she'd been battling with drugs and alcohol and sleeping rough for quite a few years. There was a young man called Aaron Gibson, who was 37. He died in McDonald's on Corn Market, right in the centre of the town, on the 2nd of December. There was a man called Simon, who was known as a big, quiet character in his 50s. Who'd been in O'Hanlon House, which is the homeless shelter, and then in shared housing. And there was a man who was known locally as Chester, who was a Polish guy who was 36. His name, in fact, was Czeslaw. He was a gardener who slept rough. He was a proud guy, and he often slept without a tent. And he was found outside near a nightclub close to where he was sometimes known to sleep.
Now it's dust.
So after your report, I went to Oxford with our producer, Lizzie, and we met some of the people you interviewed, including the lovely Monica Gregory, who used to be homeless herself.
So we're about a five-minute walk from Oxford Station, and we are looking through a metal barrier fence, and behind it is just essentially rubble.
She took us to a site where there'd recently been a huge hostel for homeless people, 61 beds there.
So they knocked it down because they cut the funding for the hostel. So County Council cut all the funding to support the shelter that was here, Lucy Faithful House. And then they've knocked it down to make student accommodation.
And what difference does that make to the city now?
It makes a huge difference to the city because obviously you've got more people sleeping out on the street.
I mean, when you go to the existing hostel, which is O'Hanlon House, which is not far away from that completely empty site, you realise that it's chock full, and especially on colder nights. It's a hostel that's built in the design of a prison, if you like. It has a kind of gantry around a central open space, just like you see prisons on TV. And on cold nights, the whole of that floor is covered with people sleeping. So they're in desperate need of accommodation, especially in the winter months.
So we're with Monica and also with a local Labour councillor called Shaista Aziz. And they said that people were having to sleep outside the hostel.
That's right. I mean, I saw five tents, for example, right next to the hostel alone.
Most don't want to sleep in the shelter because due to the fact that drugs and alcohol in the mix, people's mental health has a huge impact of people sleeping in. Some people can't cope being around other people. You know, we've also got the hidden homeless that you don't really see. Maybe once in a blue moon they come out from their hiding place and come and have food and whatever. Especially women, they sort of tend to go into hiding a bit due to being kicked and spat at.
Yeah. Hiding where?
Bushes, fields, tents.
I've met women who have told me that they wash in the river. I mean, it's really cold, so imagine that. This whole thing about how many beds and all of that is important, but it doesn't tell the story. So it's about really, really vulnerable people who sometimes have been failed since they were kids. You know, from a very young age, they might have been sexually abused. They've had some very serious trauma happening in their childhoods, and they've never been assisted. And then as adults, they've ended up on the streets.
When you look into homelessness, and particularly the sharp end of it, the deaths that you're talking about here, are there particular factors that you see repeated in different cases?
Well, I think, I mean, the first thing to say is that normally something really bad has happened in their lives. But then there's a quick unravelling, and that unravelling of a life that leaves you rough sleeping can be down to things like not being able to have a home that you need. So a shortage of affordable housing is, you know, everybody says it all the time, but it is clearly an issue in terms of rough sleeping and homelessness. Mental health problems, cuts to mental health services, and the accessibility of mental health services is really a recurrent theme. I mean, welfare cuts make things, you know, difficult as well. And the organisations that are trying to help, those that are trying to kind of wrap their arms around the people who are suffering and who are struggling, are also strapped for resources. So it's a resource issue, it seems. But if you draw back into the stories of most homeless people, then you'll find that this could happen to anyone.
Monica said she'd seen more women on the street in Oxford. The thing that seemed to have happened in a number of those cases, including her own, was domestic violence.
Can I ask what happened? How did you end up in that situation?
Domestic violence, being beaten, black and blue, pulled around, shoved down the stairs, stabbed. You name it.
Where did you go? What do you do in that situation?
The only thing I could do was leave, and that's when I ended up sleeping outside and being homeless.
So you mentioned one of the people who died, Sharon Maz, and we heard a lot about her when we walked around Oxford. She was clearly a huge character. You've mentioned that she was 44, a mother and a grandmother. What else do we know about her?
Coincidentally, she'd spoken to The Guardian in August last year about how she was trying to get on top of things and she wanted to try and have a new start. We know that, as is common, I suppose, with lots of people who become homeless, there'd been a kind of crisis in her life, and that related to domestic abuse, and that had led to her losing custody of her children. And from there was a period of substance abuse and problems with drug addiction and rough sleeping for years and years.
And she had talked about her own life previously, not only to The Guardian, but also in these YouTube videos that she appeared on in 2011 and 12.
I can't change anything till I get permanent accommodation, you know, and because I fled mine through domestic violence. Until I get that back, you know, somewhere that I feel that's mine, is like, because when you're living out homeless, you're living day to day, you know, it's hand to mouth, literally. So I don't know how I'm going to be able to progress.
I mean, what did you think when you saw those videos?
The thing that jumped out from those was that she was very aware of the problems that she was facing, and that she didn't feel that she had the support around her in terms of going through a detox or getting the right methadone prescriptions.
What do they want me to do then? Go out and start injecting in my groin again? I have to keep buying it illegally. But I can't have a detox either because I'm homeless. You're not allowed a detox if you're homeless. You've got to have a bed.
There was a kind of sort of tragic element to it, which is that she really felt she could get through this, but she wasn't really being supported. And the other thing about those videos that was amazing was that she was talking about her previous life as a social worker, as someone whose job it was or role it was to help homeless people, and that she had that perspective on things.
Hi, my name's Leslie Prince. I'm 30 and I'm from Oxford. Yay!
We met a guy called Leslie. Lovely guy. Seemed to be sort of turning his life back into a positive direction, but had had many years living homeless in Oxford. He'd been a heroin and crack cocaine addict.
Well, my life was kind of always up and down, rocky, to be fair. I come from a children's home. So, like, my mum put us in care when we was young. So, like, I've never really had a home. Like, not an official home, so yeah.
And he really talked very frankly about the situation, about what it felt like to sleep on the street. I mean, he tried to joke about it. He kind of described his setup in a tent and said, oh, you know, it's really warm in there, and then laughed because it was obviously really cold.
It's a joke. It was absolutely freezing.
What is it like? I mean, how cold did it get in there?
Literally, you feel like your whole body's going to, like, just break in half. Like, you
know, yeah, Leslie was really quite honest about what it was like to be begging on the streets.
You're only begging a lot of the time for drug addiction and alcohol. Obviously, you need that stuff when you're out there because it's the only way you keep warm in the winter. Begging and actually being rejected is an awful feeling because you think you approach somebody, how much confidence that takes to walk up to somebody and actually ask them, excuse me, sir, can you spare any change? Excuse me, sir, I need to get the bus home even though I ain't got home. You know, we do that stuff, but we're doing it to survive. So the first thing is either shoplifting or it's going out begging and asking strangers for money. And you know what? To be fair to the general public, you were amazing. I got £40 once, should I ask one person?
What?
Just looking all homeless and cute, yeah. Looking all homeless and cute.
Well, we were asking him, you know, what should people do when they walk past you? And I think Monica cut in and said, oh, give them a hug. And he was like, no, actually, don't give me a hug.
When people are sleeping rough, what people should actually do, just buy them a cup of coffee or something and just show them that you're there, you know, to support. Like, not always to be so judgmental. Like, not everybody needs money. I get that. Not every junkie out there needs money. Sometimes they just sat there for a cup of coffee, some food, some love, maybe. Even just someone to talk to. Gets very lonely out on the streets.
So I was really struck while we were in Oxford by the fact that people who had been previously homeless themselves, like Monica, like Leslie, were there to volunteer. I mean, we've talked about government cuts, and it felt to me that people and charities were basically filling in the gaps. We went to the Asian Cultural Centre, where they were setting up a lunch for local homeless people. And it was different to a normal soup kitchen because they were bringing out delicious trays of curry.
It's an Asian soup kitchen.
Yeah, it's an Asian soup kitchen, which is really, I think, what we wanted to provide is just that hot curry.
It was actually being run by a woman called Shabnam Sabir, who wasn't homeless, but I was blown away by her too.
We do chicken, lamb and kebab, so it's not just food, it's the best food we can provide. So my, you know, in our faith, if we are going to give charity, it's got to be the same as what we have ourselves.
And she says that particularly in Islam, there is a thing that when you help people who are less fortunate than yourselves, you don't give them lesser things. You give them the same quality food that you would want to eat. Do we know how dependent cities and towns are on the generosity of people like Monica, Leslie, like Shabnam?
Well, you've just put your finger on it there, haven't you? Which is that she was saying that you really should be giving people just as good as everybody else gets. And it is incredible. You see this more and more around the country on all sorts of issues, which is that after quite a long period of withdrawal of the state, that people have kind of given up complaining about that and they're just getting on with it themselves. And, you know, it doesn't work in the long run, but you do see some people really standing up and showing extraordinary character to try and fill the gaps that are left. Certainly in Monica's case, she's just freelancing essentially and spending her time acting as a kind of mobile citizens advice bureau for homeless people in Oxford, which struck me as completely extraordinary.
So we heard lots about Sharon while we were in Oxford. And she had talked about her own life previously, not only to The Guardian, but also in these YouTube videos that we mentioned. And she said she had three wishes.
Have someone to live. My children are with me. and just be back, you know, to living like a normal person. Yeah, that's my three wishes, yeah. Hello? Sorry. Yeah, that's my three wishes.
Do you know what the system can do to try and help someone before they hit rock bottom?
I think all the things that Sharon said in the years before she died show that there are plenty of opportunities to catch people before they fall all the way down to rock bottom. And clearly, she was frustrated again and again by the lack of support and almost by the bureaucracy of not being able to get the help that she knew she needed. The issue, which I'm not sure too many policymakers are grasping yet, is that people who are rough sleeping and homeless need an extraordinary amount of resource and wraparound care to help them get things back together. So, you know, there is this idea, for example, about housing first, which is essentially instead of going up a pathway of, you know, from a hostel to temporary housing to more permanent housing, you just take a rough sleeper and you put them straight into permanent housing. So they've got the base, they've got a security, and then you start making sure that they have all of the support they need to get off the drugs or get off the booze or the mental health problems or to get the job or to stick with the job. And that takes, you know, extraordinary amount of effort and expenditure and also commitment to ending it, which has to persist not just at a kind of top line manifesto level, but has to be shot through all of our local authorities. And I think we've got a long way to go until we can get back to having that sort of approach and that sort of philanthropic approach really towards helping these people.
I once spoke to somebody about a loved one whose life was spiralling a little bit, and I was asking them about things like drug addiction and mental health issues, and they were a former alcoholic, and they said the thing is you've got to hit rock bottom before you can start to get your life back. But the problem is not everyone survives hitting rock bottom. And I feel like almost that's what you saw in Oxford. What responsibility does the state have in trying to prevent people from reaching that situation?
I think that's a question that we all have to ask ourselves in terms of our politics and what we want from the state and how much we're willing to put in to our sort of social security systems, to use that term in its literal sense. And I think the only way of really getting the electorate to start thinking that would be a good thing would be to sort of increase our understanding of homeless people and rough sleepers as the funny, clever, talented people that they actually are, and that they've just fallen on very hard times.
To read Robert Boo's reporting from Oxford and across the country, go to theguardian.com. Coming up, are liberal white people holding up progress in how we talk about race? Welcome back. Now, The Observer's Nosheen Iqbal has interviewed the sociologist Robin DiAngela, author of White Fragility, Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism.
So this book is about exploring the counterproductive reactions white people have when their assumptions about race are challenged. And it talks about how these reactions maintain racial inequality.
We become highly fragile in conversations about race. We consider a challenge to our racial worldviews as a challenge to our very identities as good, moral people.
The book is addressed to white people. It's asking them to consider what whiteness is and to consider that it shouldn't be problematic to identify something as white in the way that we do when we talk about Asian people or black people. And it sort of shatters the notion that white is the default setting for humanity. And in a white Western colonial context, it asks people to consider what it means when our institutions are majority white and how that system then disadvantages people of colour.
And part of being white is I was not raised to see myself in racial terms. I understood that somebody had race, but not really me. And I definitely was not raised to see it as relevant to anything you could know about me. So what if I'm white? What does that have to do with anything?
A lot of people still believe that just because, you know, they don't use the N-word or the P-word and, you know, they're nice to their brown waiter and, you know, their Uber driver, that means that they're not racist. And her view is that unless you're actively working to be anti-racist, then just being benign isn't enough. There's a lot of validation, there's a lot of feeling seen by this book because it talks about stuff that as a person of colour, as an Asian person, you feel and you know, but you wouldn't feel comfortable saying. The fact that I find it too uncomfortable to say to people that what you've done and said is problematic and here's why. Because you don't want to be that person all the time. Like, oh God, you're sensitive about everything. You don't want to be the person who's accused of not being able to take a joke or is always complaining about race stuff and just can't let it go. I would love to let identity politics go. I would love to not write about it. Like, I write about it maybe like once out of every like 50 pieces, and it's the only thing that people assume that I work on. So you have to be very careful. You have to sort of pick and choose your battles, basically. And it shouldn't be like that. I would like to gift this book to about, you know, 50 people. If you don't think you need to read this book, I would absolutely say definitely 100% you need to read this book. If your immediate response is to eye roll and think, oh God, another one of these, or if it's a bit of a shrug, or I can't be bothered, then examine what is that response? Why is that? Without understanding your own history, you don't understand the reasons for why things are the way that they are and how you can change that. And for anyone who thinks that, you know, things don't really need to be changed, well, then look at the state of the world. I mean, look at where we are with Trump and, dare I say it, with Brexit, and, you know, how those two sides are divided and how that narrative was sort of stripped down to one side being stereotyped as, you know, racist and ignorant and the other being elitist and arrogant. We are going backwards. So we really do need this conversation that the book has started.
That's all for today. My thanks to Robert, Monica, Shyster, Leslie, Shabnam and Nosheen. Today's episode was produced by Elizabeth Cassin and Miles Martignoni. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executives are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. See you tomorrow.